Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The View from Here on 95.9 FM in Bozeman. I'm Jeff Milchin, and here with co-host Steve Kirchhoff.
Hello.
And today we're talking with Megan Lochner of Haven, a Bozeman-based nonprofit organization that works to provide safe intervention for survivors of domestic violence, as well as preventing future violence from occurring. So welcome, Megan.
Hi, thank you.
So I'd love to start off just giving folks kind of a sense of what the work of Haven is and the problems that you're working to address.
Yeah, so like you mentioned, Haven serves and supports survivors of domestic violence. We also serve survivors of stalking, sexual assault, and sex trafficking. Our work revolves really around serving survivors through our 24-hour support line, which is 406-586-4111. That really is the first contact that survivors have with Haven. From there, they're connected to other services such as our emergency shelter, counseling, support groups, legal advocacy, and then the entire time they'll have survivor advocacy as well. We can also connect them to other resources in the community, such as Bridger Care has a program specifically for survivors that Haven's working with. We can connect them with HRDC if we need to. Sort of whatever they are needing, we have different resources that help Haven, and then our own resources that are specifically serving survivors of domestic violence.
So can you give us a sense of both within Southwest Montana and nationally, kind of the scope of the problem?
Yeah, definitely. So domestic violence is often referred to as a shadow epidemic. It's happening at increasing rates, and we're seeing more people coming out about domestic violence happening in their homes. For women, it's about 1 in 5, and men, it's about 1 in 7. So it's a big problem that's often not talked about. With kind of more recent movements like the Me Too movement, we're seeing more women come out about the violence that they've experienced in their life, or sexual harassment or sexual assault. So we're noticing it more happen nationally, and in Bozeman specifically, we are seeing that we're pretty on trend with the rest of the country, with about 1 in 5 people experiencing domestic violence.
And what's been the impact of the COVID epidemic on the issues that you're confronting?
Yeah, so typically in a normal situation with domestic violence survivors, they are being isolated typically by their abusers. So their support systems, like their family and their friends, are being cut off from them. They may even be getting communication to the outside world cut off through their phones or their computers being monitored. So with that isolation, during, you know, when COVID-19 kind of took off and we saw all the stay-at-home orders happening, and kind of end of March, early April, we noticed that this is going to be a big problem for survivors living at home with their abusers. One, because they are isolated even further. There's, you know, a fear of seeing family and friends due to the pandemic, and also with financial instability potentially from unemployment, fear in general and stress in general that can increase domestic violence in homes. So we have seen a big impact, specifically with, we've noticed that our online chat support, which is sometimes more accessible for survivors at home with abusers, because they are maybe not able to pick up a phone and call for fear of their abuser hearing them. So our online chat support actually went up 300% during the stay-at-home order. And then once the order was lifted, in Montana at least in early June, we noticed a 1,000% increase in need for shelter services. So for us, that kind of showed us that once survivors were able to leave their home and feel a little bit more comfortable leaving their home, they were seeking shelter and wanted to get out of their situations. Kind of on a more national scale, we saw a big increase around America. And then since other countries were kind of going into lockdown and stay-at-home orders before the U.S. was, we were watching reports from France and all of these other countries that were saying domestic violence is increasing here, prepare for it in the U.S. So around that time in March, Haven really tried to be proactive in ensuring that we had a survivor advocate at all times, able to talk to a survivor, whether they're calling on the online chat support or whatever it was. So we've noticed a big increase just due to that isolation.
So in response to this increase activity, did Haven increase staff, or how did you meet the increased demand?
We mostly increased staff hours. So our survivor advocates around March and April ended up taking on a little bit more hours than they had before. We do, thankfully, have interns typically from the Montana State campus in the counseling programs that will help man our support line, man our online chat, and just help as backup as much as possible. So we definitely worked a little bit more with volunteers and just and made sure that we had a staff available at all times. Mm-hmm. And that meant kind of working through what that looked like virtually, because typically this is very in-person work, wanting to make sure that we are there with survivors. So that was kind of a learning curve for survivor advocates to ensure that they were still there for survivors and actually meeting an increased need and also staying safe and keeping survivors safe as well.
I imagine it's a delicate service to provide, right? That requires some subtlety and some know-how to do. Do you rely on interns and volunteers, or what sort of training is required before a person can step in and help with this increased demand?
So we have a couple different trainings. So we have our kind of standard volunteers that are able to help with, maybe they'll just come in once a week and help with like filing paperwork or something. And we have our interns. So they will join us for typically a semester or maybe two semesters if they're really enjoying their work with us. And we start them off with a weekend long volunteer training. So they will learn everything about our services, everything about domestic violence that we can give them, and then learn how to answer calls on the support line, and specifically active listening and kind of showing that empathy for survivors and listening to survivors and meeting them where they're at is kind of the most important thing for Haven. We work off the empowerment model. So during these volunteer trainings, that's a big proponent of it, is teaching all of these volunteers and interns what the empowerment model is and how to model that through their conversations with survivors. From volunteer training, if someone is going to be taking our support line or working with survivors directly, they will then go through a series of what we call just shadow shifts. So they'll work with the survivor advocates. It's about 4 or 5, you know, 6 hour long shifts where they will kind of monitor the phone calls. They'll start taking some phone calls towards the end of it so that the survivor advocates can kind of hear how they are interacting with survivors. And then from there, they are able to take the support line, usually while a survivor advocate is with them as well. So,
you said the word empowerment. That's a part of your discourse back and forth with someone who's in need. Can you say more about what the empowerment is about?
Yeah, definitely. So we want to work to meet survivors where they're at. So that also can mean using their language that they're using. We refer to survivors as survivors, or if they're working with us, as participants. But if a survivor is more feels more comfortable using the word victim, that would be that'd be a way for us to say, okay, if that's how you want to kind of refer to yourself, that's totally fine. And we want to empower you to use the language that you want to use. And then we also make sure that our survivor advocates are not ever giving advice. So if someone is calling and saying, hey, I am in a situation that I think is domestic violence, what should I do? Our survivors will listen to them and talk them through what they know. And kind of give information, but at the end of the day, we want to empower survivors to make those decisions for themselves. And that may be them deciding to move out and come to our shelter. It may be them seeking legal advocacy and possibly filing for an order of protection. But at the end of the day, it's the decision of the survivor. And typically in abuse, we see that abusers are trying to maintain this power and control. So they may have been in these relationships for years where these survivors have a lack of power. So we really want to make sure that these survivors are getting their power back and getting their voice back, because it may have been, you know, kind of taken away from them for so long. And we know that it's in there, and we know that they're strong and able to do it. But sometimes, I mean, that's hard to find kind of on your own.
When Haven receives a call, someone has dialed 587-4111, right?
586.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
No, that's fine. I just want to make sure the right number is out
sorry
there.
Sorry about that. 586-4111 is the Haven line, and that's not a 911 call. So is this clearly in when someone makes the call, they are at least temporarily in a safe space where they feel they're comfortable enough to make the call?
Typically, if someone does call us, we have kind of an initial, if this is an emergency, please call 911, and we would rather someone seek that emergency help if they are in a dire situation right then. But typically when people call us, they are in a safe place. We also ensure that they, if we need to call them back, that they are also in a safe place. It's safe for us to leave a voicemail. It's safe for us to even call their phone. But typically, we see people are in a safe place at that point. If they maybe are not in a safe place to call, they will reach out through our online chat support.
Mm-hmm. And at that time of that phone call, there's a lot of active listening, as you said, and the effort to empower the survivor who is calling, and then I suppose some mention about the full suite of services that you can provide.
Right. Yeah. So when a survivor first calls, typically a survivor advocate will just begin asking them about their story and just tell me, why are you calling? Tell me a little bit about, if you're comfortable, tell me a little bit about what you're going through, what's happening, what you are seeing as domestic violence, and then survivor advocates can kind of assess from there if it feels like domestic violence or not. From there, they can, tell them about all of our services and kind of offer services if they want to pursue any of those, like shelter or counseling, or can direct them maybe if someone is just needing to get out of their home, mm-hmm. and they can direct them to HRDC, something along those lines.
Is there a situation that's more typical than others? Something that you're used to hearing more often than other kinds of calls?
It's a good question. I would say here it's very standard to hear kind of the typical narrative that a lot of people put on domestic violence. We will hear maybe a woman reaching out, sometimes with kids, sometimes without, and just experiencing domestic violence from a partner that they may have not realized was domestic violence for a while. And it does not always show up as physical violence. It can be showing up as mental, financial, psychological. So that's where a lot of questions come up, because people are just wondering, is this actually domestic violence? So I would say that's a pretty typical call. Typically, they just have questions to start on their situation, what it means, and how to kind of take the next steps. And that's where that empowerment comes in, where a survivor advocate can just tell them, here are your options, but at the end of the day, it's up to you. I wouldn't say we have like one narrative that's, kind of more prominent than others, but I would say that's what we see more. And we are trying to kind of change the narrative in the Gallatin County, knowing that domestic violence affects men, it affects LGBTQ+ individuals. So we want to make sure that everybody knows that our services are here for everybody, not just women. And we cannot house men in our shelter currently, but we're still here for counseling and survivor advocacy and all of our other resources.
And with the recent increase that overlaps with the COVID, has it been sort of equal increases in all these different categories you're talking about, where there's maybe physical violence or there's psychological sort of tormenting environment going on or control of finances? Is there one domain, one sort of form of domestic abuse that is increasing more than others?
That's kind of hard to say. Not quite that we've noticed. Towards the beginning, we noticed a little bit more that there was, financial stress, and that increases domestic violence. So just going off of that and our numbers increasing from COVID, we could kind of correlate the two with that might be increasing as well. And that's why domestic violence is possibly increasing. But it's kind of across the board. Mm-hmm. And typically if someone is experiencing mental or emotional abuse, they are most likely experiencing some other forms of abuse as well. So mm-hmm. they kind of go hand in hand a little bit with each other.
All right. So in the introduction on your website, it mentions domestic violence as well as sex trafficking and stalking as mm-hmm. different types of people you're serving experiencing those problems. How common are issues around sex trafficking and stalking amongst the clientele you serve?
Yeah, stalking we see a little bit more maybe after people have gotten out of domestic violence situations. So sometimes they'll leave their abusers and find safety and shelter, and then that's maybe where we're seeing stalking coming up, is this ex-partner is now trying to reach out in various forms. A lot of the times that may be where our legal advocacy comes in, and someone wants to file an order of protection. Sex trafficking, it is becoming more apparent in Bozeman. We've been noticing it more because we have these cheap flights from Las Vegas, because we are on the freeway. So we're noticing sex trafficking coming up more.
What does that typically look like? I don't have a very clear idea of what that scenario is likely to entail.
Yeah, so typically someone that is being sex trafficked may not even know that they're being sex trafficked. So a term in sex trafficking is called boyfriending. So someone will start having a relationship with whoever they are trafficking, and it looks maybe like a very normal relationship. They are just dating, they're a boyfriend-girlfriend or boyfriend-boyfriend, whatever it looks like. So whoever's being trafficked may just think, oh, this is, you know, my partner, this is who I'm in a relationship with. And then maybe a situation starts coming out where they are being trafficked to their friends, maybe without their knowledge that their boyfriend or partner is getting paid for this. So often when we are working with sex trafficking survivors, they may not know what is happening. And we, again, coming back to our empowerment model, we're not going to sit here and say, hey, we think you're being sex trafficked. They may recognize at a certain point if they are given information about about sex trafficking. But typically it is pretty hard to pinpoint. For survivors, they may be coming to us because they think they are in a domestic violence situation, which can also be present, but they may not know it also might be sex trafficking. And that's typically what we see in Bozeman. In Billings, a little bit more what we're seeing is like illicit massage parlors and stuff like that. So that might be a little bit more obvious to the people that are working there that they are being sex trafficked. But in Bozeman, it typically is people that are in situations that may not realize that they are being trafficked, and then they kind of understand later once they're in the court system a little bit more.
Okay. So going back to the issue of stalking, you mentioned it's usually someone who was previously in a relationship with a person. Does it happen much at all that just someone becomes obsessed with another person out of the blue that they don't have a pre-existing relationship with and start to do criminal level stalking?
Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely present. Typically with what we see, it's they know who this person is. They were maybe in a relationship with them. Or if it is more out of the blue, it maybe was a very short-term relationship. And then this person that is stalking has become obsessed and is kind of growing this further stalking every single day. And maybe it was just like a 1 week relationship. So this other person that is being stalked may not have felt that same connection. Mm-hmm. But typically it's long-term relationships, and then they get out of this domestic violence situation and find safety. But the abuser or stalker may be finding them after that and still reaching out and still following them and any other means that they are trying to.
All right. So your site mentioned that you have served more than 1,000 people in the past year, mm-hmm. and that you handled over 5,000 calls from folks. Mm-hmm. Should we extrapolate that from that most of the people you serve are calling multiple times, or are there a lot of calls that are just asking questions that don't require follow-up of services? Give us a sense of what's happening there.
That 5,000 number is unduplicated. So that is 5,103 separate people calling. Okay. That can be a lot of different things. So obviously in that number is that around 1,000 survivors that we served. So they're calling, and they may be calling multiple times a day or multiple times a week as we're working with them. So that number is in there, but we also are working with, it could be a concerned family member just asking questions about domestic violence. It could be just people around the community that have questions about domestic violence. It could be people that are calling saying, hey, I think I'm in a situation, I just need more information. And then they may not use our services from there, but they just wanted to get more information initially. So it can be kind of a variety of different calls. But that 1,000 number is within that 5,000 just individual survivors. It is, or individual people calling it is 5,103.
So, and those are that's the number of people you actually end up having some type of ongoing or follow-up engagement with?
The 1,014 is typically more of that number. So the 1,014 is everyone that we've served. So whether that's counseling, shelter, support groups, that is kind of who we typically have an ongoing relationship with and continue serving.
So to just continue with the amount of service that you provide, and it spans more than the geographical boundaries of Bozeman. Right. Yep. Your service area is, how would you define that?
Yeah, it's Gallatin County, but it's whoever can get to Gallatin County. So we are serving survivors from all over Montana and really all over the U.S. if they can get to Bozeman. And we can help them in various ways, whether they need a bus ticket or a train ticket. If they're trying to get here, we want to help them as much as we can. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that may also mean just referring out to another shelter or another service. So in Livingston, even, we've which is in Park County, we've got Aspen. So sometimes if people are in Livingston and aren't really able to make that commute to Bozeman, we can refer them to Aspen. And so we'll try to refer to other organizations when we can if they're not able to get to Bozeman. But a lot of times we see people wanting to get here and access the services that we are able to offer.
So 1,014 survivors were served last year by Haven. That's an impressive number.
Yeah.
That's a lot. That's a busy year.
Yeah. Yes, you know, it definitely
that's,
is.
That's three a day or something almost, right?
Right? Yeah.
So obviously you want the survivors who are calling to live in a more secure environment, have healthier right. relationships in general.
Yeah.
But how do you sort of define success? You know, when you serve 1,000 people, what would you say, oh, this was a successful case
right.
for everyone?
Yeah. At the end of the day, I think success on a very individual scale would be this person is in a healthy place, they are safe from their abuser, they have kind of found their own empowerment, they found their own voice, and they're able to kind of move forward feeling confident that they get out of the situation and knowing that they made the right choices. And success can also look different for everybody. So with our legal advocacy, we help with filing orders of protection. And some people may look at success as I was able to get a permanent order of protection. Sometimes we know, though, with abusers that can escalate a situation. So that may not be in the end successful. So it kind of depends on the individual scale. I would say for Haven and our survivor advocates, I think they just want to reach that level of empowerment with survivors and ensure mm-hmm. that survivors know that they have their power and their voice and they can use it and go forward in healthy relationships if they so choose to go forward in other relationships, but just ensuring that they know that they have power and they have control and it's not in the hands of another person.
Would you say that the gist of empowerment or that the effort in empowerment is that like a counseling service? Does that overlap with the counseling, or is that different from what you might call a psychological service?
Yeah, definitely. It can, I think, the counseling services can really help with it. I think that in survivors talking through their trauma and kind of healing in that way, they find a lot of empowerment through counseling. Our survivor advocates really work towards that as well. They're not counselors, but they are still using this language to help empower survivors. And a lot of that just comes, honestly, through active listening and helping survivors be able to talk through what's happening without putting anything on them, without saying, oh, this is what you experienced. It's more survivors being able to kind of talk through their situations and feel empowered because of feeling heard and listened to, which maybe, again, in their relationships with an abuser, they may not have felt that for years. Counseling, I think, helps a lot. We've had a lot of survivors say amazing things about our counseling services because this may also have been the first time that they're able to access something like that and really work on their mental health and their emotional well-being while also feeling empowered.
So when you are dealing with clients who don't have an instance where physical abuse is involved,
right.
where it's financial, emotional, or otherwise, since there's not an explicit crime being committed, is there any way that you try to take action to get the person who's the abuser known to law enforcement or to other agencies so that even though there may not be a prosecutable crime, there's
right.
some record to alert others?
So it's really up to the survivor if they want to call law enforcement and charge or just, you know, essentially just let them know what's going on. They may not choose to charge them with anything.
Mm-hmm.
But there is, so in Bozeman, there's victim services. So they operate kind of after law enforcement has been called. So law enforcement gets called. They will typically, if they think the situation is domestic violence, they will refer them to victim services. And then victim services is there to walk them through their options as well, which a lot of the times may look like an order of protection. On our end, we can tell people, if you want to call the cops, you can do that. That is definitely an option. And we can also inform them of what that might look like. Sometimes I think it can be really helpful because if an abuser is very respecting of law enforcement, then they may feel a very real threat of, I need to, you know, kind of mm-hmm. stop doing this and work on myself and whatever that looks like. Sometimes we see that it may escalate a situation. Our abusers may feel attacked or just angry, honestly, about having the cops called on them. So we know that it, in some situations that might be the answer for some survivors, but at the end of the day, we want that to be up to the survivor to make that call. And if they choose to do so, we will continue to work with them and walk them through what their options look like. But typically, if they choose to call law enforcement, they may get referred to victim services. And if victim services think that they might work really well with Haven, then victim services can also refer to us.
And amongst the cases where you are dealing with physical abuse, you have a rough idea of what percentage of those cases law enforcement ultimately is and does get involved?
I don't. I'm sorry.
That's fine.
I am not curious. Sure on that, actually.
It seems like a difficult thing to predict whether your abuser is going to be discouraged or enraged by that decision to call the police. How do you make that decision or advise people to make that decision about whether or not that's the right path or not?
A lot of it comes down to safety planning. So if they are reaching out to a survivor advocate or a legal advocate, typically right away, those advocates will start walking them through safety planning. So whether that looks like making sure that you have a go bag at all times, making sure that your phone is not being bugged by them or your computer's not being bugged, ensuring that they may have some support system to pick them up at any point. They can stay somewhere that is not identified by the abuser. A lot of that, I think, would come down to safety planning, and if they're going to call the cops, that could potentially have an escalated situation because of that, making sure that they can get out of their home and out of that situation safely. So a lot of that kind of goes into the decision making, and that's kind of what our survivor advocates are here for, to help people plan to stay safe as much as possible, and we want to make sure that we are advocating for safety and understanding that it's a very real risk.
It sounds like you have a very impressive suite of services to give people in really powerful and very unstable situations. And we focused on how you handle situations when you get a call and what do you do once that is received. What about the other arm of what you provide, which is prevention? How do you try to prevent this from happening?
Right. Yeah. So a lot of it is in community education. So I think there's a lot of maybe misinformation about domestic violence. And so we are working to get as much information out there as possible about what domestic violence looks like and who it can affect, which is everybody, and kind of what to look for in signs in your own relationship and then also in friends and family and kind of understand what that looks like. So a lot of our communication or community education comes in the form of accessing schools and accessing kind of the younger generation so that they understand, A, what a healthy relationship looks like, and then on the reverse, maybe what an unhealthy relationship looks like. So one of our really cool programs that our prevention coordinator works with BridgerCare on is called Peer Education. So they have a group of, it's about 20 to 30 high school students in Bozeman, Belgrade, kind of the entire area. And they will, since it's with BridgerCare, they will also talk about sexual health, but a lot of it also is just healthy relationships in general. And they will talk about teen dating violence because it happens, even though, you know, these teenagers are not living together. There's still domestic violence in these situations. So they will go around and talk about what healthy relationships look like. And often, as we know with, you know, maybe teenagers, they may be listening more because it's from their peers. And there's not always clear education in these high schools around Montana about what healthy relationships look like. So it's working with that. And then also our prevention coordinator will work with different schools and just talk to kids about what a healthy relationship looks like.
And you mentioned that you did it in high schools. Does it go any lower in the grades? Do you go to middle schools or elementary? Or where does it start?
Not that group right now. Right now they're just in high school, but our prevention coordinator in general will work with middle school, grade school. So definitely younger. Of course, there's the concern of making sure that it's age appropriate, but we also understand that if we want to work towards prevention and kind of work towards ensuring that the community is holding abusers accountable, we need to start with the younger generation and start with young children.
I just want to remind folks, you're listening to KGVM 95.9 FM in Bozeman, serving the Gallatin Valley in southwest Montana. And we're here today talking with Megan Lochner of Haven.
Yeah, I guess I would shift the conversation because something struck me as I was listening to your sort of your MO, your way of operating. You get the call, you do the empowerment, and you do the fact-finding, active listening. And you're in powerful situations in which, you know, there's not a lot of stability, and there's a tremendous amount of fear and insecurity on the part of the person you're working with. How do staff people at Haven stay resilient in the face of what I think are very powerful situations?
Totally. We focus a lot on making sure that especially survivor advocates and our interns are taking care of themselves, whether it's their mental health or just taking time to kind of decompress from everything that they're listening to every day. So there is vicarious trauma. So survivor advocates can be experiencing this trauma with them, and it can be very, very heavy. I mean, that's a lot of emotions every day, and listening to a lot of often heartbreaking stories and heartbreaking situations. So at Haven, we have a couple programs in place where we make sure that each staff member has a wellness reimbursement every single month. So whether that's used for therapy or, you know, fitness, whatever it may look like, however people need to take care of themselves. We also have a really awesome program staff that is able to kind of share in their hardships with each other, and they're able to connect with each other and talk to each other about, you know, I'm having a really hard day, I'm having a hard time working with this participant, or whatever it may look like, and ensure that people are being taken care of emotionally and not falling kind of into that burnout that we see so often in nonprofits.
Yeah, are there specific programs where a Haven worker can go to like a Zen center or whatever? You know, I mean, is that sort of that kind of thing available to someone who's doing this kind of work?
We have had a lot of community partnerships, so we'll have some spots in town that will reach out. Like our yoga, they have offered a couple sessions about once a quarter where our staff can come in and do yoga and just decompress and relax. There's a couple other spots that we'll try to just offer any kind of relaxation or meditation, whatever that looks like to our staff. So we don't have a specific like program, I guess, in place, but there's definitely, we get a lot of support from the community that helps us out in that way.
Wonderful.
Again, I was curious, what are some common misperceptions that you come across in society of attitudes toward toward abuse?
Yeah, I would say the biggest one is that it's physical only. It's not just physical, and we see, you know, mental, financial, psychological, emotional abuse all the time. And we want people to understand that just because, you know, there's not active hitting or anything physical does not mean there's not domestic violence present, and also that it affects everybody. I think generally sometimes with domestic violence we have a tendency to paint in our heads who's being affected by it, but at the end of the day it can affect men, it can affect people in same-sex relationships, it can affect people of any social like income status. It's affecting everybody.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm thinking of other people who are affected, and that would be children, right? Or other relatives if you're living in a multi-generational household.
Right.
So do you have services provided for those who are in the environment?
Yeah, typically with children, our services aren't geared specifically towards children. We will typically refer them out maybe to like Family Promise or other spots in town that work more with children. But if a mom of a couple kids, if they are under 18, reaches out and is needing emergency shelter, they are able to stay in our shelter. That's kind of where our services with children extends. But we try to refer out as much as possible. And we also need to be cognizant of if we are hearing something that kids are potentially being abused at home, we do, our staff, they are mandatory reporters, so they will need to reach out to CPS. And so we are very cognizant of if someone is calling and talking about that, we want to let them know that that is our, we are mandated by the state to do that. So I think that's, it kind of plays into the system a little bit more in that aspect where children could be affected in that way, and we just want to do what we can as a family approach, but ultimately a lot of the times that comes down to working with their parents.
I'm just curious, since you mentioned there's, you know, a lot more than physical abuse that goes on, if you know, if a friend of yours you suspect is being mistreated in some way by their partner that's not physical, are there any warning signs or ways that you'd suggest people to questions you'd ask people to think about if they suspect mistreatment from someone they care about?
Yeah. First off, I would just say make sure that If you are approaching anybody that you're suspecting is in a domestic violence situation, make sure that they're safe and keep their safety at the back of your mind. We don't recommend reaching out to the abuser at any point. There are some models out there where there could potentially be abuser intervention. We are not working with that right now. But from there, I would say if you are suspecting that one of your friends or family members is in an abusive relationship, kind of start researching online. There's so many resources out there. Call the Haven support line or really any domestic violence support line and kind of talk through what you are noticing. From there, if you want to talk to your friend, it's our survivor advocates can kind of talk to you about how to approach that conversation and ask questions and kind of work through that active listening. Also, we don't want to push survivors away, and it can be a challenge to make sure that they know that we are here for them or you're there for them, and also ensure that they are, that their safety is one of your priorities as well, because that could escalate a situation potentially.
Very good. Thinking about abusers, is it, you know, my impression is usually these are people who grew up in abusive households themselves. Is that the reality, or are there other things people should understand about how that comes to, how people become abusive?
Yeah. There is some information behind whether abusers grew up in abusive households. I cannot remember the exact statistic right now, but there is a portion that typically they may have seen abuse their entire life. So that could play into it. At the end of the day, abuse comes down to power and control. And I think that's kind of another misconception, is that society is quick to say, oh, it's a drinking problem, it's a drug problem, it's anger management. And all of those things could be very present, but at the end of the day, this person is exhibiting power and control. We do notice that a lot of abusers tend to suffer from narcissistic personality disorder, and that may be causing them to lack empathy in their relationships. It may cause them to want more power and control in these relationships. But we are very careful to not blame it on any one thing. We don't want to say that abusers are acting this way because they grew up in an abusive household or they have an alcohol addiction. Those may be factors in it, but at the end of the day, that kind of takes accountability away from their actions and what they're doing.
I'm sorry to talk over you.
No worries.
I apologize. Thoughts occur to me while you're talking.
Yeah.
And I wonder, do you extend any services to the abusive partner of a relationship, or is it for survivors exclusively?
We do not right now. It is for survivors exclusively right now. There are in some places what are called like batter intervention programs. Some of those are maybe run through nonprofit organizations. Some are run through maybe the court system. We're not currently doing that. We do have plans in the future to engage men a little bit more. On kind of both sides, ensuring that male survivors know that they have a place to go and that their situation is just as valid. And on the other side, since we do know that women statistically more are abused by men, that this is not okay. And it is many times kind of argued over and over that this is a gender-based crime. And so, and this is a male problem that men kind of need to come to the forefront of and say, this is something we need to address within our gender. Mm-hmm. So in the future, we want to kind of work with men around the community more. That may not necessarily look like specifically working with abusers, but it could, I think, tackle that.
Do you ever have any follow-up in dealing with over 1,000 people a year? It might be unfeasible to do, but so you provide services to over 1,000 people, and do you know if the person has gone back to that relationship and is trying to work on it through counseling, or that person has gone on to a different relationship or is in no relationship? Do you do any sort of follow-up?
The survivor advocates will stay in touch as much as they can with working with so many. That can be kind of overwhelming sometimes, but they will stay in touch if that survivor wants to, if they feel comfortable doing that. It's not always specifically asking that question of, have you gone back to this person? How are you kind of doing now? I think it's more just, are you safe? Essentially just kind of checking in and just making sure that they still know that we're still here. So I may not specifically be asking those questions, but it can definitely be a check-in and just making sure that they know that Haven services are still here, and if they ever need to access our services again, they're welcome to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
curious, culturally, prior to COVID even, you know, we've had an uprising, I would say, of kind of a machismo culture in the United States, led by, as we record on January 12th anyway, the current occupant of the White House,
right,
has certainly driven a lot of that culture, this idea of, you know, that violence is implicitly acceptable.
Right.
Do you see any cultural impact of what's happening at the national level as impacting the scope of the problem that groups like yours are dealing with locally?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, kind of like you mentioned, we are recognizing that toxic masculinity may play a huge role in this, and understanding that this masculinity that is so prevalent in the U.S. culture is affecting men and their kind of how they perceive their role in these relationships to be. And because of this nuclear family model that we've had for, you know, decades, it may look like these men that feel that power and control is theirs. And that definitely, again, that's the basis of domestic violence. So as far as within kind of, you know, the last year, last 4 years, we definitely think that there's probably some impact just because it's become more at the forefront. And these, I would say, kind of men that may feel this toxic masculinity in their lives, they're emboldened in this way right now in the national kind of level. They feel emboldened and empowered on their own to be able to be who they feel that men need to be. And I think that definitely affects survivors all over.
I realize it's beyond the scope of your work with Haven, but do you have any thoughts on how you deal with that culturally, about, you know, that idea of toxic masculinity? How
right.
how do you start steering culture in a more positive direction away from that?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, I'm always going to be a big proponent for education. So I think that there's just a big lack of education around domestic violence. And I think we need to start looking at domestic violence as a community issue. I think for so long it's been looked at as kind of a justice issue, and making sure that these abusers deserve the justice, or you know, end up in jail or whatever that looks like. But at the end of the day, we need to be holding these abusers accountable. And a lot of that also, again, just looks like educating the younger generations and ensuring they know what domestic violence looks like, and they know what healthy relationships look like, and also understand what toxic masculinity really is, and how it affects their own, you know, men's own mental health, but how it can affect those around them as well.
When you try to sort of inculcate in an educational program what a healthy relationship is, how do you do that? Is that role playing? Do you read stories and talk about, you know, what the interactions and the characters of what? How does that educational outreach work?
Yeah, it's a lot of kind of everything you said. So there are stories talking about either, you know, real or fake situations that kind of are asking children or high schoolers to think critically about, does this look like domestic violence to you? Does this look like a healthy relationship? And they kind of have to identify those features and understand what that looks like and be able to think about that on their own so they can identify it on their own. There's also, role playing, which is also prevalent in our, we'll do that in our volunteer training to help people understand, if you're in a conversation, what does this domestic violence look like? How can you point it out if you're with your friends at a game night? You know, things like that. And then there's just education as well. I think there's so many different learning styles, and I think it kind of, we're trying to be accommodating to as many different learning styles as possible. But we also want younger generations to feel like they are also thinking critically about this and understanding that they play a big role in this. So for them to be able to play a big role, they need to feel confident in identifying this as well.
Do you find that the public schools are a good partner, that there's a willingness to be a place for this kind of education to happen?
In Bozeman, yes. I think they're very open here, and I think we are lucky to live in a community that is very open to this and wanting to partner with us and ensure that they're getting this education in their schools. I can't really speak for beyond Bozeman. Gallatin County, I would say, is open in general, but as far as on a national level, we kind of see over and over again that public schools in some places are failing this aspect of education. So it kind of depends on where it is. I would say in Bozeman, though, specifically, we're very lucky to have good partnerships with the public schools.
So since our listening audience extends to Ennis, Butte, yeah, and many other places around Southwest Montana, if their school system doesn't have a program like that and they're interested in finding out more, any yeah, suggestions for them?
Yeah, definitely. I would say reach out to Haven through our website. Our prevention coordinator works specifically with community education all over, and whether that looks like a virtual training, whether that looks like she's going out there and kind of speaking to certain classes, it's definitely possible. So our website is havenmt.org. We've got a couple contact spots on there, so if you head to the website, you'll find a kind of a contact form, and when you reach out to us, we'll connect you with our prevention coordinator, and she'll kind of be able to work through what those options are and if that's possible.
Great. And is there a website that shows where services like Havens are available for other communities in our listening area?
There are.
I presume if they called Haven, they'd be able to get directed pretty quickly, yeah, also, right?
Yes. On our website, we have a full page of just resources. So those will be on a national level and just extending beyond Montana, too. So if you go to Haven's website, you'll find kind of the national domestic violence hotlines, and then you will also be able to kind of find other options around the state.
Great.
So it seems like the job is a big one. Just sad to say, but a fact, yeah, right? And getting bigger. And Haven cannot do it alone. So that was going to be my question that Jeff just asked you, because it sounds like it requires a host of agencies and organizations, right, that are more or less working with each other, even, yeah, if they're not under the same funding source or whatever. So I think that's an important thing that you just mentioned, that Haven is not the only provider of services in our community, but it's a great starting point.
Yeah.
Calling the telephone and also going to the website to find out what other services might be available.
Can you give our listeners a sense of where your support comes from, you know, foundations, government, yeah, funding, private donations? How does your work get funded and what's needed to keep it going?
Yeah, definitely. So we have funding from several different places. We have some from federal grants like VAWA, which is the Violence Against Women Act. So that really helps out organizations all over the country. We have funding from private foundations, which really help us out. And then a lot of individual contributions and sponsorships from around the community. So we have a lot of community members that want to get involved. And, you know, we tell everybody any amount helps, can be down, you know, down to $5 or however much. Any amount is helping us operate on a day-to-day basis. So they're kind of all over the place, but we are thankful to have an involved community in that way.
All right.
Yeah.
And before we wrap up, just wanted to ask, is there anything that you think folks listening ought to know about the issues that Haven addresses that we haven't touched on?
I think we touched on a lot, but I would just say, yeah, be observant in your friends and family's lives. I think right now, because we're still obviously operating in this global pandemic, that a lot of people are still staying home. A lot of people are still ensuring their own safety from the pandemic, but that could mean many other things as far as domestic violence. So just check in on those around you. And if you have questions and if you're concerned, just call Haven or call the National Domestic Violence Hotline and ask questions where you're confused. And yeah.
All right. Anything else you want to get in, Steve?
No, just I would just extend my gratitude to you, Megan, right, for coming in and for the great work you're doing to try to make a healthier community. So thanks to you and thanks to Haven. Thanks,
yeah,
for today.
Thank you for having us on the show. I mean, I think this alone is big in community education and getting our message out there. So thank you.
Yeah. Megan, thank you so much for joining us today and educating our listeners about the work of Haven and the issues you're tackling. Again, you've been listening to The View from Here on KGVM 95.9 FM. We've been talking with Megan Lochner, the Events and Communications Manager with Haven. We'll see you again next time on The View from Here.